We are looking at the book of 2 Kings, and if you have done any reading in this, you realize that we cover a lot of different people and a lot of different events. And what I'm going to try to do today is point out some of the more important factors as we go along. One of the things that is most noticeable, at least about the early part of 2 Kings, is that while it's called the book of 2 Kings, in reality, much of it deals with the prophet Elisha. In fact, the whole first half of the book of 2 Kings really concerns more Elisha and his work than it does the kings. They're almost secondary. And this in itself would indicate to us the relative import here of the prophets as they begin to take over the spiritual leadership and guidance of God's people. And this will be their function, not all of the prophets, because as we said, there are false prophets, there are evil prophets, as well as evil kings and evil priests. But it is evident in the latter part of Israel's history, beginning about this time in particular, now that David and his particular rule are now part of the past history, It's apparent that for the most part, the prophets are the spiritual leaders. There are a few exceptions. We do find a few kings that are called good, and two in particular that we'll be looking at today, whose reigns were exceptionally fine. Beginning then properly at the end of 1 Kings in the 51st verse of the 22nd chapter, we have beginning in this section and running through 2 Kings chapter 11, various reigns of kings. We have in Israel Ahaziah, Jehoram, and Jehu. And in Judah we have Joram, Ahaziah, and Athaliah. Now already you note that many of these kings have more than one name, and that men of the same name are on both sides, and Israel and Judah, and this doesn't help the situation. That's one reason I've given you here the chart of the two kingdoms, and you see if you look at those charts, both that they have more than one name and that they share the same. The Ahaziah, for instance, is a name that occurs in both reigns, in both kingdoms. Joram or Jehoram also occurs in both, and then we have names like Amaziah and Azariah that sound a lot like Ahaziah. So that it's quite a task. Joaz and Joash also are names that are often confused. Joash and Jehoash being the same person. Now, I'll just have to ask you then to kind of keep one eye in your chronological chart so that you will know about whom we're talking as we move along. First, we have the reign of Ahaziah of Israel, mentioned here in the latter part of 1 Kings. It begins there and goes on over into the second book of Kings through a portion of the first chapter. We're told several things about his reign. First of all, in 2 Kings 1, verse 1, that in these days Moab rebelled against Israel. And then immediately after this, we're told that Ahaziah, the king, the son of Ahab, fell down through a lattice in his upper chamber, and he was hurt. The interesting thing about this is that he does not inquire of God, the God of Israel, the Lord, but rather of Beelzebub, who is the god of Ekron. Now, we know, of course, that Beelzebub is also known in the New Testament, in particular as he is identified as symbolic, at least one of the names for Satan, used by Jesus and also used elsewhere in the New Testament. Beelzebub is representative then of that which is rebellion against God, particularly among God's people, that is, the people of Israel at this time. He sends to inquire of Beelzebub. And in doing so, the angel of the Lord tells Elijah to go and to rebuke him. And in verse 4, the message that Elijah has to bear to the king, who is now sick, is this. thou shalt not come down from the bed whither thou art gone up, but thou shalt surely die. Another interesting aspect of this episode is that we're given here the description of Elijah, for which he is so well known. In verse 8, he was a hairy man, girt with a girdle of leather about his loins. This description is also given of John the Baptist in the New Testament, and as we know, Jesus speaks of him as Elijah coming back, in the sense that John the Baptist represents in the New Testament the last of the great prophets of the Old Testament. John the Baptist had a unique position, really. He at the same time functioned as the last of the great prophets and as also as the first of the great evangelists. He almost straddles, as it were, the Old and New Testament. On the one hand, he is like a man pointing back to the prophets of old, and he sounds like one of them, even looks like Elijah. And yet, at the same time, he can point ahead and say, "Behold the Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world." And so we see him, as it were, a kind of personification of all of God's faithful prophets, in that he specifically points ahead now to Jesus Christ. And since he is so closely identified with Elijah, and since Malachi in his prophecy, in the closing words of his prophecy, said that Elijah would come back, we do understand then that John the Baptist is the New Testament likeness to this great prophet Elijah. And we have the description of him here in chapter 1, verse 8. Now then, King Ahaziah was angered, and he wanted to get Elijah. So he sent after him, sent a captain with 50 men, and demanded that Elijah come to the king, to report to the king. And Elijah's response in verse 10, "If I be a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume thee and thy 50. And it happened. And the king, not to be undone, was able to send another captain in his 50, and the same thing happened. The third time he tried it, however, the third captain went to Elijah and pled for his life and the life of his men. And we note here the prayer, the prophetic prayer he makes in verse 13. "O man of God, I pray thee, let my life and the life of these 50 be precious in thy sight." And the angel of the Lord said, "Go down with him and do not be afraid." So he went, and he rebuked again the king for having called on Beelzebub instead of glorifying the Lord, and told him he would surely die. And so in verse 17, he did die according to the word of the Lord. Now the second event that we have record of here is the ascension of Elijah, also presumably in the same time, the time of Ahaziah the king. We're told that the Lord would take up Elijah by a whirlwind into heaven. And as this became known not only to Elijah, but apparently to Elisha and to the sons of the prophets, the school of the prophets that was built up around these two great personalities, Elijah and Elisha. In those days, we don't really know just how it happened or just what the circumstances of the school was, but in those days, there were a number of men who apparently sat at the feet of Elijah and Elisha and learned God's word, learned how to be servants of the Lord. We don't know exactly what did happen in those days, but many times seminaries have been likened to schools of the prophets, taken from this same concept of spiritual leaders who would instruct others to be able to do God's work. Now, three times Elijah says to Elisha, "Tarry here," as he moves along certain stages of his journey toward the Jordan River and beyond. Each time he says to Elisha, "Now you stay here, you tarry here while I go on." And each time Elisha says, "I will not leave thee." Now after this happens three times, then the two come to the Jordan River. Elijah took his mantle, as you remember, and smote the waters, and the river parted. Then Elijah said, "Well, what can I do for you before I'm taken from you?" And Elisha's request is that a double portion of the spirit of Elijah be on Elisha. So he desires then to be a true successor of Elijah, to be able to continue the work that Elijah has done. And Elijah's promise to him is that if you stay with me until I'm taken, and you actually see me taken up, then you can receive this blessing. Then suddenly a chariot of fire does come, and Elijah is taken up in a whirlwind into heaven. Verse 11. The cry of Elijah at that time is most significant. My Father, the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof. By which evidently he meant to say, Elijah, you were far more important in Israel's victories than all of her chariots and all of her horsemen. You are really her chariots and her horsemen. You are her strength. And he cried out then as he saw his beloved teacher taken from him. We're told in verse 13 that the mantle fell upon Elijah. He took it up. And from that point on, then, we see the evidence of the Spirit of God working in Elisha. Now, actually, from here on, we have a considerable record of the miracles that are worked through Elisha. We have more recorded miracles, the hand of Elisha, than we do of Elijah, which does not mean necessarily that he worked more miracles, but only that more at least are recorded of him. And Elisha's ministry reaches right down to that time when the writing prophets themselves begin to write. It is assumed by many, though it cannot be proven, that these early writing prophets, at any rate, came from the school of the prophets, came from those who had studied directly under Elijah and Elisha. This would, of course, make significant the fact that many miracles had been worked through Elijah and Elisha in these days. And so it was a kind of continuation. Verse 15 mentions these sons of the prophets. When the sons of the prophets that were at Jericho over against him saw him, they said, the spirit of Elijah doth rest on Elisha. In other words, they observed and they publicly recognized that he was the proper successor and teacher and leader of the sons of the prophets. Part of this assurance came to them because he duplicated the miracle that Elijah had just worked. Elijah, you remember, caused the Jordan River to part, and he and Elisha passed across. Now, as Elisha comes back across, heading west again, he does the same thing. And the sons of the prophets at Jericho, who apparently had been waiting there to see what would happen, gave testimony to the fact that Elisha was the real successor here. So the first of the miracles, which is wrought by Elisha, is the parting of the rivers again, of the River Jordan. We're told of another miracle almost immediately in verse 19, where there is a complaint that the water is bad, where some of the people in the city are drinking the water. And he instructs them to put salt in it, and they do so, and the waters become sweet again, drinkable. And again, we see that it is a miracle. In verse 21, the statement is said, thus saith the Lord, I have healed these waters, and there shall be no more any death because of them. And then the third miracle is recorded also in the second chapter. This one has to do with an incident that took place toward Bethel. As he was walking along, certain young children, boys, came out and began to mock him. And they said, go up, thou bald head, go up, thou bald head. And he looked behind and saw them and cursed them in the name of the Lord. And there came forth two she-bears and tore up 42 lads of them. Now, this has caused a lot of difficulty with a lot of people. Many people say, how could a moral man, how could a good man, a man through whom God worked many mighty miracles, have done such a thing as this? Why would he have done this to the children? Well, I think two or three things have to be recognized. First of all, it said that he cursed them in the name of the Lord, which would seem to indicate that he did it by the will of God. Remember that these children were dishonoring God's servant. They were heaping ridicule upon him. Now, why would they do this? It possibly, at any rate, could reflect the attitudes of their parents. Like parents, like children. The mockery that undoubtedly was heaped out upon God's children in that day, as it is in every age, was particularly here centered upon this personality, upon Elisha. And it might be possible, though I cannot prove it, that this reflects the attitude of the parents that they had heard the children the children had heard the parents ridiculing or in some way speaking in a derogatory manner about the man. And so they simply reflected that. The punishment falls upon the children, but we can know, of course, that it was of great pain to the parents. Another thing that has to be noted here is that, after all, it was not Elisha who did this, but God. God is the one that sent out the bears, not Elisha. It seems to have been then a form of God's judgment against the people who would not respect or honor his servant. It's imperative in the plan and purpose of God that men should so honor those whom God calls to be those through whom he will give his revelation to the church. He goes on to Mount Carmel and then on to Samaria, where the king lives. Now we move into the reign of Jehoram, also of Israel, and we're also told that he was evil. Again, we note that in this whole section, from the third chapter through the ninth chapter, Elisha is the chief subject. In these days, we have the record in verse 4 that Mesha, king of Moab, led a rebellion against Israel. And for a time, apparently, his rebellion was successful. And for a time, he apparently was able to set up a separate kingdom until Elisha was able to lead the people back to a victory. Now, we know something about Mesha, the king of Moab. Archaeologists have actually found a stone which was cut by him, which he gives a record of his rebellion against Israel. Apparently, Mesha was a little overconfident, at least as seemed to be the nature of all the ancient kings when they put their records on the stone. They boasted too much. Mesha boasted that he had utterly defeated Israel. The Bible shows us that it was not quite that way, that later on Israel came back and defeated Moab. But the stone itself is a record of these same events that we have recorded here in 2 Kings 3, and therefore one of the more important archaeological finds. In those days, when they were doing battle with Moab, there was a scarcity of water. This was one of the problems. The great army of Moab was another problem. And Elisha is called on for help. Elisha, when he's asked to give help to the king of Israel and the people of Israel, says in verse 13, "You go on to your prophets and the prophets of your father and your mother." Remember that it was his father who had called upon God Beelzebub to help him when he was sick. Elisha says, "Go on back there. Why are you looking to God for help?" But after the insistence of the king, he then does promise to do what he can. Interesting here in verse 15 is that he requires a minstrel. And it's only when the minstrel comes and plays for him that he begins to speak the will of God, that the hand of the Lord came upon him. Now, this has led many to assume that the prophets always had to have some kind of a minstrel to play background music in order that they could prophesy. There does not seem to be any evidence of this throughout Scripture, however. Why it was done here, we're not told. Just exactly what its relationship is to the prophets prophesying at any time, we cannot be certain. But certainly one incident does not establish a principle. He instructs them to make the valley full of trenches. You remember there was no rain in those days, and it was dry, and the people had no water, and it seemed perhaps a senseless thing to do. But it was to accomplish two things. First of all, it supplied water. We're told about this in the 20th verse. But more than that also, as the sun rose the next morning on this water in the trenches, and the Moabites in the position where they were saw it as red, and they assumed it was red blood. And they assumed that somehow the Israelites had fought one another and destroyed one another, therefore that the blood was their blood, and they came rushing down, and when they did, the Israelites rose up and defeated them. This again is one of the recorded miracles of Elisha, and shows the truth of what was said about Elijah is also true about Elisha, that they're really more effective than all of the chariots and all of the horsemen of Israel. Chapter 4 is the incident of Elisha and the Shunammite woman. This particular woman is particularly dealt with in the 8th verse following, but incidental to that, and just prior to that, is the story of one of the wives of the sons of the prophet, not to be identified with the Shunammite woman we'll talk about in a minute. Apparently in her days, her own husband had died, and she was a wife of one of those in the school of Elisha, you see, the sons of the prophet. And the creditor was come to take the two children to make them slaves. Now, this in itself was against the express will of God, according to the law. Nevertheless, it would indicate the lawless way in which the people lived in those days. God's answer to her need at this particular time was to instruct Elisha to have her go and get all the vessels that were empty that she could borrow. And then God miraculously brought oil into these vessels, and by means of the oil she was able to raise enough money to set herself free of debt. Now this would indicate God's great concern for the widows and for orphans. This concern that is here expressed in God's own direct intervention in one poor woman's wretched state is to be expressed over and over by the writing prophets. And I suspect that Elisha himself told this story many times to show how concerned God was about the injustices that existed among those people in Israel in those days. And when we get into the study of the prophets, we'll see that over and over the prophets warn against God's judgment to come on people who act just as apparently this creditor was acting in regard to this poor widow and her two children. It's interesting that we have this incident, and we can imagine that it was one of the foundation stones to show God's great concern. Then he goes to a Shunammite woman, and this woman living in this place was very gracious. She and her husband were gracious to Elisha, and whenever he came by, they had a little room that they prepared, a little chamber, and they had a bed and a table and a seat and a candlestick. And seminary students take notice. Now, these are the only essentials of any minister of the word. So don't look for luxuries in life. If you find a place with a bed, a table, a seat, and a candlestick, you have all that Elisha had. And he came there frequently then, and he wanted to bless this family for being kind to him. And they had no children. And so he instructed them, assuring them that they would have a child. And the child came according to the promise. Then we're told in verse 17 following here that after the child was born and one day was out with his father in the field, he got a headache of some kind, his head hurt him badly, and he finally died, according to verse 20. Word was sent to Elisha, and he finally came to the child. In verse 32, Elisha came to the house, and behold, the child was dead. He went in, he shut the door, he prayed to the Lord. He laid upon the child, putting his mouth to the mouth of the child, and finally the child's life returned. Now, this was clearly a miracle, one of the remarkable miracles of the Old Testament, the bringing back to life of one who was dead. There have been those who have tried to argue that the child was really not dead. They said it was just an example of the kind of resuscitation that we have today. For instance, the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, in which people who have been presumably dead have been brought back to life if they had been drowned or something. Well, we need to note that the scripture says specifically in verse 20 and then again in 32, the child was dead. He just wasn't out. He was dead. And he was brought back to life, and it's clearly a miracle and registers as a new miracle of Elisha and one of the few times in the Old Testament that one dead was brought back to life. We have another miracle recorded in the latter part of this chapter, Elisha and the poisonous stew, whatever we might wish to call it here. At any rate, here apparently something that the sons of the prophets were cooking up got some poison ingredients into it, and it was about to kill everybody. It was at least poisonous and endangered the lives of the people. And again, Elisha tells them what to do. They're to put meal into it, and it took away the poison. Some would say, well, this wasn't a miracle. It was simply a chemical reaction of some kind. Maybe so. God many times worked his miracles in ways that we don't understand, that the people in that day did not understand. It does not take anything away from the miraculous event itself. Very clearly here, it was a change in the substance to the extent that that which was harmful was now edible. And the indication again is that it was a miracle, that it was a supernatural event. Clearly, in verse 42 following, another supernatural event, the feeding of the multitude, which is reminiscent, of course, of the miracle which Christ himself wrought twice in the New Testament period, taking a few loaves and a few ears of grain and multiplying them and feeding a multitude by means of them. Chapter 5 tells us the interesting account of Elisha and Naaman the leper. In this incident, we have mention of Naaman, the captain of the host of Syria. You remember, of course, that the Syrians and the Israelites were traditional enemies. Now, in these days, the Syrians captured, as it were, a young girl and took her into Syria. She was among the Israelites. This little girl had heard something about the great man Elisha. She learned that Naaman, her master, was a leper. She expressed one day in verse 3 that there was in Samaria a prophet who could heal. Naaman, not knowing any more details and apparently not being able to find out any more about her, came down, sent by the king of Syria to the king of Israel, who was to heal Naaman the leper. Well, immediately the king, of course, when he got word of this, was greatly distressed. He said, who am I to heal? What does the king want to do? Destroy me? Is he looking for a reason to fight me? But finally, the matter comes to Elisha, and he volunteers to heal Naaman. Naaman comes to him, and in verse 10 he says, go wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be made clean. Well, this really did irritate Naaman. He had come all the way from Damascus down to Samaria, a good journey, just to be told that he should go wash in the river 7 times. He said, we have bigger rivers in Damascus than this. Why should I go here? But a very interesting thing is said by one of his counselors, one of his servants, really, in verse 13. My father, if the prophet had bid thee to do a great thing, you wouldn't have hesitated to do it. Now he's told you to do this, so why not do it? He did, and he was clean. Another miracle at the hands of Elisha. It's interesting to see his response. He is one of the few Gentiles in the Old Testament period who clearly is converted to God. We're told then that he believed in God. In verse 15, behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, take a present of thy servant. Now, we're not told about the present at this point. Later on, we're given an insight into that. But ultimately, the prophet would not take a present. But again, we see this common idea in those days that a prophet did his prophesying in order that he could make money. He says, I will receive no money. I will receive no present. And then Naaman in verse 17 desires to take some earth so that he might offer sacrifices and worship the Lord on the Lord's soil. It's an interesting thing that he did. He was probably the first person to ever take some soil from the Holy Land and take it back to his homeland. It's been done ever since by the tourists. I suspect tons of dirt have passed through customs offices from the Holy Land. Also, water from the Jordan and from the various wells, Jacob's well and so forth. So Naaman, in a way, can be registered as the first tourist to the Holy Land. He also makes one rather pathetic plea here in verse 18. It says, when my master goes down into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and that is his own God, and leans on my hand, may the Lord pardon me. In other words, as long as I serve the king of Syria, I know he's going to expect me to do this. And he asks that the Lord pardon him. Well, Elisha's response is, go in peace. God makes no real comment on this particular request. That God later on demands of his own people that they not compromise in such a manner as this is quite clear. At the same time, we don't know really anything of the future of Naaman. He fades out of the picture. It seems clear that he did take the Lord to be his God. And that is about all that we can say about it. It was not God's intent that at this time there should begin to be a people of God, however, in Syria, because there's no indication that he went back and that there was any further conversion of people. Gehazi, the servant of Elisha at this time, when he learned that Naaman had offered a gift and Elisha had not taken it, decided it was time for him to make some personal profit. If Elisha wouldn't, he would. He sent word to Naaman and said, well, he would be willing to take a little money and some raiment. He did this in the name of Elijah. In the name of Elisha. He thought he got away with it, just as Achan, you remember, when he stole the things out of Jericho, thought that he got away with what he did. But God had shown Elisha what Gehazi was doing. And so when Gehazi returned, the leprosy of Naaman came on him. We're told of this then in verse 27. So here we see a double miracle. First of all, the leprosy is immediately removed from Naaman, and then we see it applied to Gehazi, the servant of Elisha. Chapter 6 goes on with some of the miracles. The floating axe head, as we're told of this in the first part of the chapter. And then the particular incident surrounding the famine in Samaria in those days. The king of Samaria, of Syria, warred against the king of Israel. And we're told that in those days, the king of Syria would, in his private tent, make certain plans how they would outmaneuver the Israelites. But every time, the Israelites were ready for them. Finally, the word came to the king of Syria that the prophet Elisha was in Israel and that he was just like being in the tent of the king of Syria. He knew everything that was going on. He sent to try to capture Elisha, just as the king of Israel had formerly done. He surrounded the city of Jotham, where Elisha was staying. The servant of Elisha, presumably Gehazi, but we don't know for sure. Anyway, the servant of Elisha was frightened. He saw the armies. Elisha said, Lord, open up his eyes so he can see the greater armies with us. They that are with us are greater than they that are with them. So his eyes were opened, and he was able to see that the mountains were full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Another miracle, the vision that was given to this young man to see the mighty power of God that stood with Elisha. Then a further record of those days in which the famine increased in Samaria, as the king Ben-Hadad, as he's mentioned in chapter 6, verse 24, laid siege to Samaria. You remember we said that Samaria was well defensible, but it could also be shut off from communication with the rest of the world. And this is one of those times when the city of Samaria, that sat on this big hill in the middle of the valley, was completely surrounded by the enemy armies, and God's people in Israel sat up here on the hill, and they were not able to get out to get any food, and the food was scarce, and the people were in real trouble. Something of the awfulness of that era is shown here in the sixth chapter. When one day the king, as he was walking about, heard a woman cry, "Help me, O Lord," the king. And she said, "Well, what?" He said, "What's the trouble?" And the woman said to him, "This woman," another woman with him, "said unto me, give thy son that we may eat him today, and we'll eat my son tomorrow. So we boiled my son. And then I said to her the next day, give thy son that we can eat him. And she hid her son." What a picture of those days. The king, when he heard it was too much for him, he rent his clothes. And he was angry because of Elisha. Just why he was particularly angry with Elisha, we don't know, except that at this point he would be angry because Elisha wasn't doing anything. Elisha, at the direction of God, finally said, "Don't worry, tomorrow at this time, a measure of fine flour will be sold for a shekel here, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria." Now that kind of prices in those days indicated superabundance of food, not scarcity. One of the captains of the army's host laughed and said it wouldn't be possible. Elisha said, "Oh, it will happen, and you'll see it, but you will not enjoy it." And it happened just as he said. God, in a miraculous way, caused the army of Syria to flee away suddenly and leave all of their goods. And so all of the army here that had been surrounding the city, they just took off, and they left all of their goods and all of their horses and everything, cattle and everything. And so the people were able to go out from the city of Samaria down into the valley, gather together all of these riches, and bring it back to the city of Samaria. And as they did so, this captain who had laughed at the prophecy of Elisha was trampled underfoot by the people, undoubtedly, as they were hurtling through the gates in order to try to get some of the food. Chapter 8 tells us something of the reputation of Elisha in those days, and how the king, on the basis of Elisha's reputation, restored a certain widow's property to her that had been denied her. And then also, beginning in verse 7, we have the account of Elisha and the king of Syria. And in this case, the king of Syria was sick, Ben-Hadad, so sick that he desired to know what his future would be. He instructed one of his generals, Hazael, to take a present to Elisha in order that he could inquire of the Lord. So you see something of the reputation of this man, that even in Syria, even in these nations outside of the orbit of Israel, the man Elisha was respected as a man of God. As Hazael came to inquire about Ben-Hadad, his master, Elisha said in verse 10, "Go say unto him, thou shalt surely recover. Howbeit, the Lord hath showed me that he will surely die." Now this may sound like a contradiction, and in a sense it was, as far as the future of the man was concerned. But apparently what was meant was this: the man can recover from his illness, but he won't be allowed to. And he goes on to explain to Hazael that he knew that Hazael would be the king, that Hazael would succeed his master, that he would be extremely cruel to God's people. And this is exactly what happened. Hazael went back. He told the king, yes, you'll recover. The very next day, he smothered to death the king and took over the reign of Syria. Beginning in verse 16, we're told about the last days of Jehoram, the king who reigned during most of the time when these events in Elisha's life were recorded. In rapid succession, we have then the record of the death of Jehoram. We have the record of the beginning of the reign of Jehoram, king of Judah. And we are told that he was wicked, having walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and that he took the daughter of Ahab to be his wife. Note again in verse 19 that God, in spite of all this, would not destroy Judah, in spite of the fact that one of her kings had married into the family of wicked Ahab of Israel. Using the same phrase we've seen before, as he promised him to give unto him a lamp for his children always. In those days, Edom revolted, and also Libna, according to verse 22. Ahaziah of Judah's reign begins in verse 25. His mother's name was Athaliah. She was that one whom Jehoram had married. And so when Ahaziah died, Athaliah, who was of the family of Ahab, would for a time take over and rule in Judah. At this time, we're also told in chapter 9 that God told Elisha, and Elisha in turn commissioned one of his own to go and anoint Jehu to be king over Israel. Jehu was the one chosen by God to wreak the revenge on the family of Ahab and Jezebel. And so Jehu's commission was to go and to bear out God's judgment against Jezebel. And we're told then of this judgment of God through Jehu. Jehu is anointed by the prophet to be the king. He begins by overthrowing the ruling king, the descendants of Ahab, and we're told of this in chapter 9. Jehu himself, in verse 30 following of chapter 9, is responsible for the death of Jezebel, and she is cast out of the window. He's responsible for the death of two kings, the king of Israel and also the king of Judah. Remember, all of these are part of the family of Ahab now. And according to the promise that God had made, he would destroy utterly the whole family of Ahab, as he said through Elijah long before. Then in chapter 10, Jehu is recorded as having wiped out totally all of the sons and all of the children of Ahab. In verse 1 of chapter 10, we're told that Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. Jehu's way of doing this is interesting. He wrote letters to those who were in charge of those sons and said, now, you pick from among his 70 sons one who will be his successor, and then we'll go to battle with him. Well, the masters, the servants, and these who had charge of the sons said, look, we don't want to be involved with them. I know you're going to kill them. We'll take care of it. So they cut off their heads and send them to Jehu in a basket. Well, Jehu's response is that he will punish these men who did this just as surely as David punished those who told him about Saul's death. And so in verse 10, Jehu leads to the punishing also of all that remain of the house of Ahab and all of his great men and his familiar friends and his priests, and he left none remaining. Well, he had another task, and that task was to wipe out Baal worship. And the way in which he did this was to invite all the Baal worshipers to come to one place, sent word throughout the whole kingdom of Israel. Chapter 10 tells us how he gathered every one of the Baal worshipers and got them all together, and he said, "Now, is there anyone here who's not a Baal worshiper? Because I want to honor Baal, but I don't want any unbelievers of Baal in here." And finally, they're certain that there's nothing but Baal worshipers and that every Baal worshiper is there, and then they're all completely done away. Well, it was an effective way of getting rid of Baal worship. And never again was there Baal worship in Israel. There was in Judah, but not in Israel. It was totally obliterated that day. Verse 28 tells us of chapter 10, "Thus Jehu destroyed Baal out of Israel." But Jehu was no better. The last part of chapter 10 tells us that he continued in the ways of Jeroboam. Now the scene shifts in chapter 11 to Judah. We're told that Athaliah, who you remember was one of the descendants of Ahab, had married into the family of Judah and had come therefore to live in Judah. That Athaliah, when she learned that Ahaziah, her son, who had been ruling in Judah, had been killed by Jehu, she destroyed all of the royal seed. We're told of this in chapter 11, verse 1. All that is but one named Joash. He managed to be spared so that the seed of David was not completely wiped out. Joash was hidden for 7 years, and finally Jehoiada the priest brought him out, and he was declared to be the king. We're told about this in chapter 11. And then we're told at the end of chapter 11 that Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. And the reign of Joash is a mixed reign. As long as Jehoiada the priest, who had protected him and anointed him king, as long as he lived, according to verse 2 of chapter 12, Jehoiada was a good man and did right in the eyes of the Lord. We're not actually told in 2 Kings what he did that was sinful. In Chronicles we are told, and we'll look at that at a later time. But it does imply here that his reign was not altogether righteous in the sight of God. An interesting incident during this time, while Jehoiada was still living, the king Joash desired to repair the temple that undoubtedly had been mistreated and overlooked for some time. So he determined to repair it, and one of the ways in which they raised money to repair it, as we're told in verse 9, is Jehoiada the priest took a chest and bored a hole in the lid, put it by the altar, and people were able then to drop in their contributions. This is reflected in the present day. Even I've seen churches that have what they call Jehoiada's chest, where for building or repairing a building, people are permitted to put their money into the chest in a special offering. Chapter 13 continues the sordid details of the negative kings, the sinful kings of Israel. Jehoahaz of Israel is mentioned here. Wars continuing in those days between the king of Syria and Israel. Jehoash is also mentioned as a king of Israel who was evil, beginning with verse 10. And in these days, Elisha took ill, and we come then toward the end of Elisha's life. And we're told that the king of Israel went to him in those days. And in verse 14, he addressed him in the following way, my father, the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof." Well, here he was quoting Elisha's own words in respect to Elijah. Now these same words are applied by the king of Israel to Elisha. And the promise is given by Elisha that God will deliver Israel out of the hands of Syria. In spite of the sinfulness of the people, in spite of one king after another following in the ways of Jeroboam and not doing God's will, we can still see God concerned for his people and determined that he will deliver them out of the hands of their enemies. In all of this time, God's concern is, of course, that some of the people in Israel will hear the word of the prophets and will repent. After this final promise of Elisha, he dies, and there's one miracle more connected with the man Elisha. He's put into a sepulcher, and then one day, sometime later on, as men were about to bury another man, they were under attack, and they threw the man hastily into the sepulcher of Elisha, and when the man's body, dead body, touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and came back to life. And this is the last. I've counted some 15 miracles that are recorded in the life of Elisha. And the last of these is this one here in 13:21. So the life of Elisha ends, and we see that the kings really are just part of the background in this period, that what's really important is the prophet Elisha. And what is really significant in this whole section is that God has begun now to lead his people by means of the prophet. And the reason why we're going through this background in 2 Kings is to lay the foundation, the historical foundation, for the prophets that God will raise up during the same time, particularly now beginning with the period as it's recorded here in chapter 14 following. So in the next hour, we're going to study particularly the historical background against which the writing prophets, beginning with Joel, will begin to prophesy in Israel. So we'll resume our study, chapter 14, in the next hour.